is paid for or reimbursed by federal government or the state of Minnesota under Medicare or Medicare, a private insurance administrating Medicare or Medicare, or a managed care organization that furnishes medical services in lieu of Medicare or Medicaid under agreement with the federal government of the state of Minnesota. With me today, I have Jackie Anderson from Key Medical Supply and Sarah Anderson, Key Medical Supply. I also believe there is an A1 amendment, and I had to move the adoption of that to put the bill in the proper form.
So, members, you should all have the A1. So, this is the A1 to Senate File 677. Senator Howe has moved adoption of the A1. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. A1 is adopted. Hang on a sec, Mr. Senator Howe. I want to make sure we all have the paperwork in front of us. And members, as we take testimony, I understand there's also an A2, so we'll hand that out at the same time as well. Thank you for letting me interrupt, Senator Howe. So you have, is it Ms. Anderson?
Yes, I have Jackie Anderson from Key Medical Supply, and I'd like to have her present her testimony.
Ms. Anderson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. We're also representing our trade organization, MAMES, Midwest Association for Medical Equipment Services.
And Ms. Anderson, if you could just say your full name for the tape.
Jackie Anderson.
And members, I'll just note we have a quorum present. Ms. Anderson.
Thank you. Just some background on why we're here and the purpose for this bill is, as Senator Howe explained, this is to take third-party transactions out of the sales tax law. That has been Minnesota's historic position prior to 2005. That was changed when the SSUTA was adopted. There had been no notice of that change, that exemption being exempt or taken away, until we happened to have gone through a field audit. And we challenged it, and the Revenue Department published new facts bulletins in April of 2009 explaining that. So effectively, from April of 2009 forward is when the exemption has been removed. Now, it's important that we understand, first of all, what a retail sales tax is. And I just want to go over that briefly because it's important as I get into some further testimony. Sales tax applies to retail sales of taxable services and or tangible personal property of sales made in Minnesota. Businesses collect the sales tax due on items and services sold at retail on behalf of the state. The retail sale means any sale, lease, or rental of tangible personal property for any purposes other than resale, sublease, or subrent. This is from the instruction booklet revised July 2009. A use tax. The definition given by revenue in the instruction booklet is that a use tax is due on taxable items and services used in Minnesota if no sales tax was paid at the time of purchase. While sales tax is collected by the seller and paid to the state by the seller, use tax is self-assessed and paid by the purchaser, the end user. The purchaser pays directly to the state. Under third-party payers, which includes the Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance programs, these third-party payers who pay on behalf of the individuals using the products have refused to pay the sales tax on claims. Medical supply vendors are required to deliver the product first and then submit a claim. This is how healthcare claims processing works. Payment is made 30 to 45 days later. As I said, third-party payers have refused to pay the sales tax. When we've added that to our claims, the sales tax line has been denied. Revenue, however, assesses the tax liability to the merchant when it is not collected at the time of sale. We have no mechanism as a medical vendor to collect sales tax on third-party transactions. So that definition of retail sales is important. If you go into a store and purchase a product, you go to the counter, you pay for it, you refuse to pay the sales tax, you don't walk out with that product. In our world, as I said, we have to actually physically deliver the product and then submit the claim for payment. And then we wait 30 to 45 days to actually receive the payment. Options for us are to go back to the Medicare-Medicaid historical exemption, which is what we're offering in our bill, or to pass legislation forcing insurance companies to pay the sales tax as a separate line item. I don't think that one is going to go very far. So what we're asking in our bill is that that historical exemption for Medicare and Medicaid be put back in. And we're also asking in the amendment, and I haven't seen it yet, but our House testimony, the chair asked the legal counsel to work with us on providing the exemptions on the products, and we're going to talk about those here in just a moment. Okay, good. What happens in this situation if we don't get relief through this legislation is the medical supply companies will be paying a penalty. It's not a sales tax, it's a penalty. Because the tax law regarding a seller who refuses to collect the sales tax does not apply in this case. We've tried to collect the sales tax. There is no mechanism for us to collect this tax. Also of troublesome nature to us is the product definition used by revenue, according to the SSUTA agreement, are inconsistent with medical industry practices, making it nearly impossible to comply with both federal HIPAA-regulated claim submission requirements and Minnesota Revenue's direction. We are seeking legislative relief. That's our only recourse. The other issue that we're facing last year and this year is dealing with inaccurate revenue forecasts. Accuracy in those forecasts are essential, especially in this climate of pay-for mentality. The industry is being forced to defend against an illusion, and we'll talk about those numbers in a moment. Medical supply use and reimbursement is complex and not standard retail transactions, which is the foundation of sales tax law. Reimbursements are made by established fee schedules, which in the past 5 years have had no relationship to our actual costs to provide those services. They are also static. They do not accommodate a variable sales tax schedule. Merchants should not be put in a position of paying this business penalty. The variable tax rates in Minnesota range from the base rate of 6.875% to 16.275%. So somehow, if we were to even get a tax rate into the fee schedule system, where would you put it? Those fee schedules, as I said, are constant. They're static. And so let's assume that it goes in at the base rate. We still have up to that 16.275 percentage that would be assessed to us as a penalty. Also in the instruction booklet from Revenue, it asks the merchants to list the sales tax separately from the sales price whenever practical. If we can't do that, then we must publicly post a notice that states that the price includes all applicable sales tax or state on the invoice that tax is included. We can't do that on a third-party claim. I'm going to turn this over to Sarah Anderson at this point.
Hello,
another,
my name.
Another Ms. Anderson. Yes.
Another Ms. Anderson in Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Anderson. I'm also with Key Medical Supply and represent the Minnesota Medical Equipment and Suppliers Association. I'm going to talk a little bit about what is the definitions. As Jackie mentioned, there are some divisions between the SSUTA definitions of medical products and common industry definitions that create numbers of problems for medical vendors, both in the claim submission problem and in attempting to apply sales and use tax according to revenues bulletins. When you look at the fact sheets, there's exemptions stated for mobility-enhancing equipment, prosthetic devices, durable medical equipment. The implication is that those items are exempt. But under further review of the revenue published fact sheets, there are numbers of inconsistencies. In the fact sheets, exempt items include most drugs, prescription and over-the-counter for use by humans, repair labor, if it's separately listed on the invoice. Now, in some places, billing with Medicare and Medicaid under their HIPAA-regulated definitions, we are not allowed to separate labor. It's included in some of our services. So even though our repair and we have repair and labor costs, we can't break that out on the claim for some of the types of repairs that we do. There's also exemption for resale, goods and services purchased solely for resale. The inconsistency here comes in some of the kit definitions in these fact sheets, where if the kit is not taxable to the individual we sell, the supplier is expected to pay use tax according to our instruction. We are also assessed penalties for interest on the sales tax that we cannot collect. As Jackie said, our third-party payers have refused to pay the sales tax, and yet our business, in addition to the variable rates on sales tax, are also expected to be assessed penalties for not paying the sales tax. Under current law, we are, again, expected to be paying a tax that's uncollectible to us. And in the further inconsistencies within the instruction booklet, within the fact sheets for durable medical equipment, drugs, prosthetics, and mobility-enhancing devices, they contradict themselves on certain products. In some places, catheters, which are considered prosthetic devices by common healthcare definitions, are considered prosthetic devices and exempt. In other fact sheets, they're considered single-patient-use durable medical equipment and taxable. And they're expected to be used, worn on the body or in the body in some places and not in others under the definitions that we are given. They're never not worn in the body. There are inconsistencies in common products. If you have an oxygen system and you use a nasal cannula are exempt. But if you need a face mask to deliver your oxygen, face masks are taxable. If you are fed through a tube in your stomach because you are no longer able to orally consume nutrition, the tube in your stomach is a prosthetic device and it is exempt. The pump, which regulates how quickly that formula flows into your body, how quickly your food flows into your body, is durable medical equipment, and it is exempt. But the absolutely necessary tubing that goes between the pump and the prosthetic device are taxable. So life-sustaining enteral feeding administration systems are taxable. If you have a tracheostomy, your tracheostomy is exempt. But the filter that keeps bacteria out of your lungs is single-patient use DME, and it is taxable. Under Medicare and Medicaid, many of these supplies are billed in kits. When we supply a tracheostomy, we supply a filter. When we provide a daily kit for enteral nutrition, it includes some taxable items, some non-taxable items. Under our instruction booklets, we are instructed to separate out the price of the taxable items from the non-taxable items and charge tax on only those individual pieces. That does not comply with HIPAA-regulated billing instructions at the federal level. So it really becomes a conundrum for businesses because we, in addition to not to having the refusal to pay by insurance companies, we have a billing system with no possible mechanism to distinguish the instructions were being provided under revenue. At that, and Jackie mentioned some additional problems with the revenue estimate, so I will turn it back to her to discuss those items.
Ms. Anderson won.
Thank you. Last year, we didn't know where these numbers were coming from, and this year, I was happy to see that revenue provided that on their revenue projection sheet. And that information comes from the National Health Expenditure Data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. When you look at the definition of those numbers, however, it's of great concern to us. They aggregate products under the definitions that I talked about earlier that are common in healthcare. And so many of the items that are exempt under mobility devices and DME under revenue law in Minnesota are part of the numbers that are used under the NHE data. So that's a problem. The other problem is that the fiscal year 2012 numbers that we received just a few days ago is 4 times higher than the projection that was done in fiscal year 2011. Obviously, we're very concerned about that. The revenue estimate for this year is roughly about $5 million, goes up slightly from that. We also have a retroactive feature in our bill going back to April 1st when that revenue correction bulletin was published. And so there is a catch-up period that revenue has put into the fiscal year 2012 numbers. And we also question that. Based on the work that we've done with our members and talking with the people that are in the medical supply and equipment business in Minnesota, there have been very few people that have paid tax on these items. There's just not the money in our business to do it. And if you look back at that those numbers that I talked about in the variable tax rates, we're not collecting that money. So it's not held in trust for the state as you would normally do in a retail transaction. That becomes money out of our business because we've not been able to collect that tax. In 2010, last year, the 2011 estimate that was given, we had a trade-off, actually a revenue add, by including some of the items that are exempt over the retail counter. But the two areas that we're talking about, the Medicare Medicaid exemption and the DME single patient use and repair and replacement parts exemption, totaled only $1.2 million last year. And this year we're being told that it's somehow magically $5 million. Now, we looked at the NHE data ourselves. We know what the 2010 expenditure is in Medicaid for fee-for-service. Roughly, that's about $52.6 million. If you look at the NHE data, this is from 2004 now, Medicaid sales are $573 million. To get even close to the number that we know is actual for 2010, we just did a 10% ratio because all of those products in the NHE data, of course, don't apply. So we're using the 10% ratio as saying only 10% of those items would apply to these taxes that are in the current law. We come up with a number of $57.3 million. So it's close. It's still higher than what we know the actual numbers are to be. But just to prove this out, we use that 10% ratio for the Medicare DME aggregate numbers under NHE, and we come up with applicable sales of $14.6 million. Taxable sales would be $1.5 million, bringing in sales tax revenue of $100,000. On the Medicare drugs and non-durables, now you can imagine that the drug portion is the bigger piece of this, but we still use the 10% factor. We come to a taxable sales area of about $1 million and sales tax at the 6.875 base rate of $70,000. So we're looking at about $532,000 from our numbers that might be collectible in the current law if we could get to those accurate numbers. Now, the only way to get to those numbers is to do a request to Medicare and Medicaid to have them pull data based on the product codes that are used on the claims. We have to do that through Freedom of Information. It takes a long time. Revenue, however, I'm assuming, could simply ask for those numbers and come up with more accurate dollars. So that is why we are before you and asking for relief legislatively on this bill. And we ask for your support.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. I know this has been a long journey for all of you, and it's a pretty thick issue. Mm-hmm. And thank you for starting to walk us through it. Senator Howe, do you have, we have the A2 in front of us that I'd like to act on for
Mr.
you.
Chair. Mr. Howe. Chair and committee members, I have the A2 amendment. I do want to make an oral change to the A2 amendment at line 1.21 and line 1.22. At line 1.21, after the word effective, I'd like to insert the word retroactively. And On line 1.22, I'd like to line out June 30th, 2011, and insert April 2009.
Madam Chair. Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, the oral amendment was retroactively. To what date are you going back to, Senator Ho?
At line 1.22, you would line out June 30th of 2011 and put in April of 2009. That would make it consistent with the other parts of the bill.
And, Mr. Chair, and Senator Howell, every once in a while we do consider retroactive bills, but could you – somehow I missed the retroactivity in your – the addressing retroactivity in your presentation. Could you explain to me why you need to go back 2 years?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I'll let Ms. Anderson talk to that. Just one more clarification there. On line 1.22, it should say April 1st, 2009. So we have an exact date. And with that, I'll let Ms. Anderson speak to this retroactiveness.
So, Ms. Anderson, on the retroactivity piece.
Okay, thank you. We're asking for retroactivity because for April 2009 because that is the first published notice from Revenue on the change of the exemption of Medicare and Medicaid sales. And so from that point forward, if this bill goes through, let's assume effective this year, then we still have exposure from April 1st of 2009 until the bill takes effect. And so, again, as I explained, we cannot collect that tax. It is uncollectible. It's not that we're refusing to act as the sales collection agent for the state. We've tried that. But the dynamic of our business is that we deliver the product to the patient. We're in home care, so it goes to their home. We then submit the bill. We are regulated to submit the bill only after the product has been delivered. If the payer then refuses 30 days later when we get paid, when it's adjudicated, there's nothing we can do.
Senator Limmer.
Senator Howe, do you have an opinion from the Revenue Department on the retroactivity issue? Are they in favor of that?
It's Senator included Howe. In their, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, it's included in their fiscal note, the retroactivity. They do address that. That's why the number is so large for 2012.
Well, Mr. Chair.
To follow up, this wouldn't be I'll let Ms. Anderson speak to this, but I don't think we're in a situation where people are going to be filing for tax money back. This has not been collected. So, right. I think there's going to be a big discussion of whether or not, in fact, you can collect this tax. This was discovered through a audit process. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, sir, how the fiscal note may reflect that, because departments and agencies are required to create a fiscal note for any proposal we make, just because they analyze from a financial perspective the cost, that doesn't mean that they're endorsing your idea. Do they support this idea from a department level?
Revenue?
Yes.
Senator Ms. Anderson, to that question?
We've met with Revenue, and they're not forthcoming with their opinions, but the impression that we got 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago when we met with them, is that they understood the problem that this has created, and they were looking for ways within the definition parameters of SSUTA to make this work. And in fact, that's what happened when we testified before the House. We were instructed to meet with the legislative attorney for the House Tax Committee and to work out this language so that it could meet the definition parameters of SSUTA. And that's what we did. That's what this amendment accomplishes.
Yeah,
Senator Limmer, to your point, I understand Mr. Cummings is here from the Department of Revenue. Would you like to ask them to give us a quick opinion on this bill and the language in front of us?
You can stay.
Good morning.
Well, I'm not Mr. Cummings.
Sorry. Good morning. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Susan Berry from the Department of Revenue. As this bill has been amended, previous to the A2 amendment, we had some concerns about streamlined sales tax of conformity. But with these changes, it occurs, at least from the first read through, that those problems would be taken care of. Our concern before was with the durable medical equipment. Currently, the law exempts durable medical equipment for home use only, and under the streamlined sales tax agreement, the state can put certain limitations on that exemption in that it can either be for has to be prescribed by a physician, it has to be for home use only, or it has to be reimbursed by Medicare or Medicaid or any combination of the three. And so now with these changes, it appears that those limitations are maintained and it's not going beyond that. As to the retroactivity, that's something that I know that as legislators, you always look at whether or not you want the law to be retroactive or not. I understand that to the extent we're talking about items that are reimbursed by Medicare and Medicaid, and to the extent that the sellers have not been paying it already, that what they're looking at is that, you know, we won't be able to go back after them now. We haven't had enough time to take a look at the new language to make a determination of whether or not there might also be other individuals that might be able to come forward for refund, or if perhaps there have been some sellers who have paid taxes who will be coming back and filing for refund. So I can't answer to the effect of that.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, is this bill intended to be held over for possible inclusion in a larger bill?
Yes, it is.
Perhaps the Revenue Department, before we get to that point, could review this idea and give us a more concrete direction of where they would like to see the bill by the time we make our final decision.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Berry.
Is that okay?
We'll do that.
All right.
So, members, we have the A2 in front of us. Senator Howe has moved the A2. He's also asked for an oral amendment to the A2. I'm going to ask Senate counsel to just clarify what is in front of the committee at this point with the oral amendment and the exact dates and line numbers on that.
Mr. Chair, on the A2 amendment, this amendment takes out the reference to the other third-party payers that was in the bill as introduced, and it makes a separate exemption for the accessories and supplies that do not meet the exemption under current law and makes it in compliance with the SSUTA. Mr. Chair, this was language that was adopted in the House version of the bill, so it reflects the House action to make this provision more in line with the SSUTA, and the effective date would then line 1.21, the section is effective retroactively for sales and purchases made after April 1, 2009.
Members, questions on the A2? We'd like to adopt it and then lay this on the table.
Mr. Chair. I think you have before you an amendment to the amendment, and you need to act on that first.
On the effective date.
on the effective retroactivity word as well as the April 1st, 2009.
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, I think when I went to move that, I made that amendment, that oral. Yes. I made the change with that, so we should just be able to act on that. I made the change prior to moving the amendment.
Or is it, should we act separate? Senator Howe, I think we'll get to the same place,
right.
But on the oral amendment to the A2, which includes the new language on 1.21 and 1.22, the retroactivity, that Senate Council just walked us through.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, does acting favorably on the retroactive provision raise the cost of the fiscal note by $10 million in the next biennium? I mean, I understand this issue. I met with the advocates last year, but do we really have $10 million to retroactively go back? I mean, let's just get honest about, I know we don't want to make people feel good, and we want Senator Howe to be successful with his bill, but, you know, there are some political realities we're under relative to this budget. And I think going retroactive, the way I read the fiscal note, costs about $10 million. I mean, just be honest about it.
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, I believe Ms. Sanders can speak to that, but and maybe the Revenue Department, but I don't believe the tax has been collected. So I think that's where our issue is, that you're absolutely correct, Senator Bach, that there would be a cost, but I think there would also be a cost in trying to collect it. And I think there is some feeling out there that some of the smaller mom-and-pop type smaller businesses are just going to be put out of business if this tax is tried to be collected on it. And I'll let Ms. Anderson speak to that, and also let the Revenue Department speak to that, too.
Well, I think,
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall, the point is the money's in the forecast. We're forecasted to collect this money, even though right now it's on the accounts receivable side of things, but some taxpayers owe us this money. It's the law. And I just think this would be certainly nice to do. I get that. But let's just be honest about adding $10 million in new spending to the biennium.
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, I would ask Ms. Anderson to respond to that.
Ms. Anderson. We're on the retroactivity
mm-hmm.
subject.
I understand.
Thank you.
I'm taking a deep breath so that I can control my passion. I understand that that's in the revenue forecast. As a business owner, what I'm asking that we deal with real numbers, that we don't deal with these illusory numbers that we've been given for the last 2 years. There's a way to get to them, but it's going to require some requests from revenue to Medicare and Medicaid. And that's the point that we're making, is that these numbers are inflated. And so it's very difficult for us to defend against that paper tiger of this $10 million that you're talking about. It's not there. And just the point about our industry, there are very few companies in our industry that you would consider big companies. The majority of them are small, and I mean the majority, 99%, are small businesses. If we don't have a mechanism to collect the tax, when the revenue knocks on our door, then we have to take that out of our operating budget. This is not sales tax that we've been able to collect, set aside, and send back to the state. And we're looking at 9% at the base level exposure, up to the areas in Minnesota that have the 16-plus tax rates. That's more than the businesses can do. That's more profit than the businesses make.
Members, we have the oral amendment to the A2 in front of us. I think we've had a good discussion on it. Mr. Cummings, are you approaching the table on this amendment?
Small.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings.
Paul Cummings, legislative liaison for the Department of Revenue. I just wanted to add, I wanted to thank you for coming today. We have not heard from the department's perspective the problems with the revenue analysis. So I have just been able to email a small correspondence with the person who prepared that. He has not heard any problems with the revenue analysis. So we would like to know what some of the concerns are. But we had not heard those concerns before today. So that we just wanted to make that known. And But thank you for bringing those concerns forward.
And Mr. Cummings, you will work on that. You will work on that with these folks.
We're open to working on
Thank
that.
You. Yeah. Thank you. So, Ms. Anderson, more discussion to be had, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Members, again, we have the Howe oral amendment to the A2 in front of us. There's clearly work still to be done on this bill, and it'll be laid over for further consideration. All in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The oral amendment to the A2 is adopted. Now we have the A2 in front of us. All in favor of the A2, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Senator Howe, Mr. Cummings, the Anderson twins, thank you for spending a little extra time with us this morning, and I understand there'll be some more work to be done. Thank you, Senator Howe.
Thank you.
We're going to, and members, just to be clear, so without objection, we will lay over Senate File 677 as amended for further for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Ortman, as you approach the table, because we now have a quorum, I want to briefly bring back up Senate File 367, Senator Chamberlain's bill. He had the A1, which he and Mr. Wiley laid out for us. Again, this is another bill that's going to be laid over, but just to put it in the form that we heard the testimony to, I would ask that we take up and Senator Chamberlain moves, again, the A1 to Senate File 367. Members, is that clear? All in favor of the A1 to Senate File 367, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. And again, we will, members, we will lay over Senate File 367 as amended for further for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman, regarding the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment to Senate File 367?
Yeah. Was there any testimony from the department, if they were, Revenue Department, if they were in favor of that bill?
We had Mr. Wally. We did not have Department of Revenue. They were here.
The reason I raise that question is that if you looked at the previous bill we just recognized, we're recognizing for tax purposes a much broader definition of equipment that would be exempt, accessories and supplies for transactions involving Medicare or Medicaid. That's the words. But in the Chamberlain bill, as amended, now we have this long list of very prescriptive, defined products that will be exempt. We don't use the word for this business called accessories and supplies. We get down to the point of talking about glaze and grease and grinding discs and hydraulic oil. Now, I would imagine that there's a lot more product that goes into the type of business that goes into. Why are we treating this business far different in a much prescriptive manner, itemizing things down to striping tape and tack cloth, and in the other one, if it happens to be in Medicare or Medicaid, it's just accessories and supplies. No further explanation. Why are we treating two businesses differently? Could anyone tell me that?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
Senator Limmer, that language, that amendment, that was from the DOR. They had quite extensive conversations. They wanted to broaden that out so they would hopefully decrease the number of disputes. But they did. The DOR worked on that amendment and deliberately, broaden that definition. That's actually the change from prior years for this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
when we consider inclusion in this in the future, I would hope that the Department of Revenue could be here to explain why they treat one business differently than others. And that I do understand that one is for tax-exempt purposes and the other is for deductible expenses. But I'd just like to know, why are we so darn prescriptive on a little body shop business?
Senator Limmer, I hesitate to interrupt Chair Ortman, as she wants to bring up a couple other bills
like
at this
said,
point.
Mr.
But we do
Chair,
have Mr. Mossman here.
All right.
And so you've teed up the conversation. Mr. Mossman, on the record for perhaps relating to both of the bills that we've heard this morning, and we heard a little conversation on one of the bills from your staff. So
sure.
Thank you for joining us and taking up Senator Limmer's call.
You're welcome, I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer. And I'm going to be, I know a little bit more about the motor vehicle paints, the Chamberlain bill that you're currently discussing. And so I may want to rely back on staff, and I know that you've had some conversations already about the Senator Howe's bill. One thing I think just in the way of background to point out that is a bit of a sensitive issue and unique situation with the motor vehicle paints that does, I think, pull in some of the rationale for the specificity is that this is a circumstance where we think we're for that is a bit atypical in that we're moving motor vehicle repairs is a tax-exempt service. And right now, paints, which is a supply or an input to a tax-exempt service, is taxed at the wholesale level. And so what we have is a situation where, for reasons that the industry is pursuing this legislation, we would be trying to craft language that is a unique circumstance where we would be allowing tax-exempt certificates for an input into a tax-exempt service potentially and needing to have a way where we can be assured that the materials that are otherwise taxable, i.e. paint, is actually being taxed at some point rather than being mixed in with what is then a tax-exempt service and therefore basically undermining the taxable status of motor vehicle paints and other inputs. I think if motor, in the short way to think about it, if motor vehicle repair services themselves, for example, were not tax exempt, I think that this would be a much different conversation, largely because it is not necessarily unusual for tax exempt certificates for things that are inputs into taxable services to be granted.
Thank you, Mr. Mossman. Aren't you glad you showed up here at 9:15? Members, we're going to shift gears a little bit here, and Senator Ortman has a couple of estate tax pieces of legislation that she is carrying for another member, Senator Benson. So, Senator Ortman, I don't know what order you want to take this, but this is your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a very formidable group from this point of view. I have to use my peripheral vision over there, and right now you're all head on. So very formidable group, and I want to say I am here for Senator Benson. It seems only fair since I asked her to dig in and work on this issue that at the last minute I'm pinch hitting. But I can't pinch hit for her elsewhere, so I'm pinch hitting for her here today. So I hope you'll go easy on me. She has two bills that she has introduced relating to the estate tax, and you can see that there are two fiscal notes. One is a much more modest proposal than the other. If you just look at the fiscal notes, one is an exclusion of certain farm and small business property from the estate tax at Senate File 445. It has a biennium cost in its revenue estimate of about $7 million. The other, the partial federal conformity, and we've talked about conformities a lot in this committee and will continue to, but the partial federal conformity costs quite a bit more, in fact, $170 million. So she decided to attack this in two different ways, which I appreciated, maybe two different approaches that we could consider for further action by the committee. So with that, let me just give you a very brief overview of the estate tax. Very brief. The federal tax structure previously, prior to 2001, would allow an exclusion of estate taxes paid at the state level towards your federal income tax liability. In 2001, the federal government repealed that exclusion, and that meant that every state that imposed an estate tax or inheritance tax from that point forward would be increasing the liability of taxpayers. And so most of the states actually repealed their estate or inheritance taxes. Minnesota decided not to. And Minnesota is one of very few that continues to tax estates. There are two different types of estate taxes. There's one called the estate tax, which actually taxes the decedent's estate. The inheritance taxes tax the bequest to the surviving members of the family or those that you would gift the inheritance to. So for the there are 11 states that have estate taxes currently as of 2010. They are Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New York, Ohio, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington, and also the District of Columbia. Others have let their estate taxes expire. In Minnesota, we have an exclusion of up to $1 million for estate taxes, and we have a tax rate range of 0.8% to 16%. One of the challenges of maintaining our estate tax is it's very volatile. It applies to those with the largest estates because there is that $1 million exclusion. Above that level, you've got folks with very big estates that pay these taxes. And one of the interesting comments I saw is that in August of 2005, the Department of Revenue received a check from one estate for the tax of $112 million. It's very volatile. In 2003, we collected $127 million, 2004, $90 million, 2005, $72 million, 2006, $215 million, and 2007, $110 million. So we can't really predict what happens as we tax at the time of death. This is a tax that does get imposed on the most affluent and elderly Minnesotans. But we've talked a lot in this committee about how those folks have options. They can be mobile. They can leave the state. And so we want to be very cautious about Minnesota's tax structure. Are we encouraging people to leave the state, or can we make this a place where they can retire and pass on? And I think we need to address this issue because we've been talking long and hard about how do you keep Minnesota competitive. And if other states are more attractive for retirees, we're going to lose a lot of folks in Minnesota. It's also a real challenge for business owners, small business owners that are planning succession for their business. They want to pass their business on to their spouse. They want to pass their business on to people that they've contracted with. And so succession planning for business owners and farmers is very important. And this is basically who pays these taxes. It's small business owners and farmers in the state of Minnesota. So the two proposals that you have before you, again, different in terms of their approach and in their fiscal impact to the state. And I'm going to ask Ms. Von Mosch to join us, and she can talk about the distinctions in the revenue estimates for these two different proposals. Just generally speaking for the committee, Senate File 445 is that modest approach. What it would do is it changed the definition of Minnesota adjustable taxable estate. It allows the value of qualified farm property plus the value of qualified small business property to be subtracted from the federal adjustable taxable estate. The sum of the two amounts cannot exceed $4 million. So that's the more modest approach here. And then the second, if you look at Senate File 446, increases the amount of the excludable taxable estate under federal tax law up to $5 million, and then it would become portable. So you get the exclusion up to a certain amount, and whatever one spouse doesn't use can be used by the surviving spouse. So it tries to make the approach a little bit more practical, and Ms. Von Mosch is here to talk to us a little bit about how the revenue estimates were prepared and what assumptions went into it in order to come up with these numbers.
Welcome to the committee. Ms. Von Mosch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will start by looking at Senate File 145.
which 445, excuse me, which looks at proposed changes to the definitions of Minnesota's adjustable taxable estate. And it does allow the qualified farm property plus the value of qualified small business property to be subtracted from federal adjusted taxable estate in calculating Minnesota's taxable adjusted taxable estate. And basically it goes, the revenue estimate goes through and it defines the types of conditions that need to be met for a to meet the definition of both types of qualified property. The value of the qualified property was to be included in the federal adjusted taxable estate. The decedent has to continually own the property for 3 years prior to death, and a family member, which is defined as a direct descendant or an in-law, will have to use the property for the trade or the business for 3 years after the decedent's death. And if they they have to also agree in writing that if they do not continue to use the estate, that they would agree to pay a 16% recapture. To be a qualified farm property, the property needs to meet the definition of a farm under Minnesota law and be classified as the decedent's agricultural homestead for property tax purposes. And for a qualified small business property, the property needs to consist of the assets of the trade or business in which the decedent or the decedent's spouse participated prior to the most recent year before the decedent's death. And for the most recent taxable year prior to the decedent's death, the business had to have grossed an annual sales of $10 million or less. And cash and cash equivalents are not included in the value of the business. And then I turn back to the number of taxpayers that are affected by this. And on the last page of the revenue estimate, they assume that after looking at, they created a special estate tax database to do this estimate, and they had to make a number of assumptions in terms of reviewing if they could identify whether the decedent was a farmer or if they operated a business. And I won't go into all of that detail, but based on all of those assumptions, they come down in the end to identifying that there would probably be about 220 decedents identified as farmers and 140 identified as possibly being small business owners that might benefit from this proposal. And as Senator Ortman already summarized, the total impact for both the farm property and the small business property would be about $7 million in fiscal year 12 and 13. The revenue estimate for Senate File 446 is a little more simple than that, in that the primary effect of this bill is that it excludes, the amount of the excludable taxable estate is increased to $5 million, which is the same as the federal amount. And the number of property taxpayers, again, it used the same estate tax database that revenue developed, and they estimate that between 800 and 1,000 returns might be affected by this proposal.
Mr. Chair, a couple Senator other Ortman. Points that I'd like to make in favor of both of these approaches. A couple of facts. Now, we talked about some of the high-end taxpayers with this proposal, but let me just point out that in 2007 and 2008, it was estimated that 57% of the estate tax revenue was generated from estates where the taxable estate was valued at less than $5 million. So these are not typically the very high-end folks. We're talking about small business owners with estates mostly of less than a value of $5 million. And the I wanted to point out the exclusion amounts for or exemption amounts in the estate tax compared to other states that have an estate tax, and remember there are very few that continue to have one after the 2001 repeal, three states have a $3.5 million exemption, Two states have a $2 million exemption. Five, including Minnesota, have a $1 million exemption, and Ohio comes in with the lowest at $338,000. So those the rates range from 7% all the way to 16% in terms of their top rates. So we don't compare well if you look at this. We've got an approach that reclaims quite a bit of revenue here at in a tax structure that doesn't compare favorably to other states in the nation. I think we need to acknowledge that and see if there's some way that we can dial back the disincentive to be a business owner or a farmer here in the state of Minnesota with our tax structure on estates. So with that, members, we do have some folks here to testify in support. They are Mike Hickey from the National Federation of Independent Businesses and Chris Raddatz from the Farm Bureau Federation.
Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself?
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. I'm going to go first, and then Mr. Raddatz is going to bat cleanup. I want to thank Senator Ortman for being our stand-in author, and that was a great presentation. I wish I had all those facts and figures before I showed up today, so I'm glad I heard that. This proposal, I'm speaking to the small business and the farm exclusion, the smaller bill. This was developed by the Farm Bureau, NFIB, the Farmers Union, and the CPAs Association back in 07, and a little piece of it got put in the House omnibus tax bill, and never went any further than that. So we certainly appreciate Senator Ortman bringing this before the committee today. We strongly support this. First of all, before I get into this, I just want to say that if we could achieve a total conformity with the current federal exemption for all taxpayers, that would be a very good goal for this state to achieve, even if we could pass the smaller bill. There's going to be small businesses and farms that won't meet all the requirements of that exemption. If we could do it for all taxpayers, it would certainly provide some simplicity and possibly keep people from looking for other places to live when they get older if they have a lot of tax liability, as Senator Ortman pointed out. But we strongly support the smaller bill to help family farms and businesses keep a tradition going, a tradition of commerce that's real important in a lot of communities. Small businesses and farms spend a lot of money playing defense on this issue, buying excessive amounts of life insurance, getting involved in trusts that people who have a $5 million net worth probably shouldn't be doing. That was an interesting stat Senator Ortman had about where the revenue is coming from. The super rich evade this tax. They get involved in all types of complicated trusts, and it's, you know, really don't like to see the small business or the farmer that, you know, has some liability over $1 million, most of it in capital and property, have to look at that and play defense to the extent they do. But a lot of people do because they're worried about not being able to keep the family farm or the family business going once that sad day comes in the family and they have to deal with succession up front. As you can see, there's a lot of requirements on the bill. They have to keep the business or the farm going for 3 years after. There's a revenue exemption of $10 million. You can't be over it. And the idea is that we're only protecting people here who are going to keep their business and keep their farm going. And so this is a real important bill, and it's been a moving target at the federal level for a long time. I think the best we're going to get at the federal level is maybe 2 years at a time now. But in the past, they had the exemptions going up, up, up. They had a freebie year last year if you could time such tragedies in your life. And now then they're looking at the prospect of bringing back the old law with high rates and a really low exemption. But they avoided all that with the budget deal in December. So now we know what the playing field is for the next 2 years, and that's probably all we're going to get is a two-year run with the federal government on these type of things. And so we strongly support this, and if we can find a way to do it this year, and with all the challenges we have, it would really be a great step we could take to protect family-held businesses and farms. Now I want to turn it over to Chris, and he can touch on the farm piece.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Would you identify yourself for the
thank record? You, Mr. Chairman. Chris Raddatz, Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau, and I won't repeat the comments from Mr. Hickey. It's really an important issue for the transfer of farms. Mr. Tom Peterson with the Farmers Union would be here this morning in support also, but he's over at the House watching a property tax hearing. So Farm Bureau and Farmers Union support this bill. And just real quickly, the situation with farmers, you've heard it before. They're classified as asset-rich and cash-poor, and as was stated earlier, they just can't pick up their stakes and move someplace else with their business. What's really the other point that I'd like to make is that we're seeing increased values of farmland, probably the only class of property in Minnesota that continues to increase. We had farmers in yesterday from southern Minnesota, and a farmer from Nicollet County, I was talking to him, and his property tax bill, the increase in his assessed value for his ag land this year, just the increase alone, is more than what he paid for when he bought his farm. So just the increase in values this year. Farmland in Nicollet County, there was three sales that occurred just recently, and they averaged about $6,200 an acre. Now, if you look at in history with Minnesota property tax law, we have this homestead classification for agriculture, the first tier of ag land, and they looked at traditionally 320 acres was kind of considered the base unit for a family farm. Well, if you take 320 acres times 6,200 acres, or $6,200, the recent sale in Nicollet County, that's $1.98 million. And that's really why we're here, because the current exemption is $1 million. We'd like it up at that higher number to help those family farms as they're transferring their farms to the next generation. So I appreciate your support. Really appreciate Senator Ortman here pinch-hitting for Senator Benson, and hopefully you can find a way to include, at least include 445 in your omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Senator Ortman, what motion would you want to engage in on this?
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I would appreciate the committee laying over for possible inclusion both of the Benson bill, Senate file 445 and 446, as we prepare bills going forward. I'd like to keep both in consideration.
Senator Ortman moves holdover for Senate file 445 and 446. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Ortman, you had one other bill, Senate file 529.
Mr. Chair and members, I gave Senator Benson the complicated one. Mine's pretty simple. All it does is look at our tax incident study, which we just got out yesterday from the Department of Revenue, and asks that the Department of Revenue, in the preparation of that tax incident study, include information on the distribution of the burden of federal taxes that Minnesotans pay. So we're not just looking at the state and the local tax burden, but we should be looking at the entire burden when you add in the federal taxes as well. So it's additional information. The revenue estimate says that it won't cost any more to add this information into our biennial tax incident study, and I hope the members will approve the Senate file 529 and add it in for possible inclusion.
Okay. Any questions? Yes, Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ortman, we have no control over it, so why would we frankly care what the data says? We have no control to do anything with it, so why would it be meaningful? I mean, it's not as though we generally use the report to kind of drive decision making here, and why we'd include things in the report that we may want to make a change, but we have no control over it. I don't understand why we would even do that. But
Sir Armand.
I'm not sure, Senator Bach, what you mean by no control over it. We have Minnesota statutes that talk about the biennial report and set up the responsibility of the Department of Revenue to prepare this study every 2 years. And what we would be doing is asking them to use additional information already available to them and report on that information as well, so we get an even more complete set of data in the report.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, Senator Ortman renews her motion to lay this bill over for possible or for holdover for inclusion in the tax bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Ortman, is there any further business before the tax committee?
There is. Just
all right.
Members,
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I had asked Assistant Commissioner Mossman to come to talk with us a little bit about the governor's proposal. And Assistant Commissioner Mossman, I hope that you would comment about the timing of the governor's proposed tax bills, because the governor's proposal for his budget was announced more than a month ago, and we still don't have bills. And so if you would please inform the committee what you intend as to the timing of the introduction of those bills.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the question. I appreciate getting the heads up, understanding that you were going to want some information on this. I was kind of hoping that Senator Limmer would have gaveled closed accidentally before. No.
Not so lucky.
fair question, Madam Chair and members. The language, of course, was not finalized at the time the governor's initial recommendations came out on the 15th, and required certainly some cleanup and adjustments as a part of the repricing and adjustments he made following the forecast, and we've been completing those. We have made those adjustments, and the language is in the process of being vetted, as it typically is, by the governor's office and the management and budget agency, as well as some proofing internally at the Department of Revenue. My hope certainly would be to get the information to all of you as soon as possible. My hope certainly would be to complete it for myself as soon as possible as well. I think that will be this week. I hope that will be this week, but I don't have a specific day that I can give you. But I certainly, appreciate that the language, that you can't fully appreciate the some of the governor's provisions until you're able to see and vet the language for yourself, and we'll be certainly wanting to get that to you as soon as we can.
Well, Mr. Mossman, we have a deadline in the Senate for processing our tax bill by March 25th, along with the other budget bills, and to get them through our committees. And we would like to be able to consider the governor's proposals in the preparation of our omnibus bills. I would think that would be in the governor's best interest, as well as the members of the Senate, to have his proposals available so that we could, if there is a possible compromise, find some. But we're going to need the language in order to do that. And I know you know that. But Mr. Mossman, I wanted to talk to you about another question, if you would. I've asked our page to prepare a piece of one of the pages of the governor's proposal, and if Adam, if you would pass that out now. I want to seek some clarification, if I could, Mr. Mossman, about the fourth tier 10.95% tax bracket. In the governor's written proposal, under the recommendations section, it says it would not be indexed for inflation. And Adam, if you could get that to Mr. Mossman right away. It says it would not be indexed for inflation. Can you talk about what that means?
Sure. Madam Chair, I have a couple things on that. First, to respond directly to your question, what not indexing, under current law, all of the existing brackets are indexed for inflation, meaning that in order to prevent bracket creep, so that as individual income tax earners and payers are earning more from year to year, but their purchasing power may not necessarily be improving due to inflation and the fact that it costs more for rent and household expenses and that sort of thing from year to year, that indexing the brackets would to inflation would keep people from growing into a bracket for reasons other than real gain in their income. What I can say to your additional point, and certainly so if you didn't index the brackets, more people would end up in the bracket over time. That's the explanation to your question. What I can tell you is that you will see when you get the governor's revised budget recommendations, and I think it's incorporated into the numbers, that MMB, I'm a little bit at a loss as to the timing of MMB was able to send something over to legislative staff yesterday or not, on repriced fourth tier numbers and other provisions, but the governor's revised budget recommendations do index his recommended fourth tier income tax bracket. So that bracket will be indexed like all the existing current law brackets.
So Mr. Mossman, he now has been advised or is under has the facts that if you don't index it for inflation, more and more Minnesotans would move in to that fourth tier automatically without adjustments.
Madam Chair and members, yeah, the governor is aware of that, and he did make that adjustment. To be honest, you know, I think there was some inadvertency to it early on as well, and that, you know, when we initially started modeling those recommendations, it was it's an additional step in the modeling to build the indexing in, and we weren't as we were doing that rapidly at the department, we hadn't incorporated that into the modeling either, and it didn't get into the recommendation, and that has been incorporated into the governor's revised recommendations.
Mr. Mossman, with all due respect, it seemed like a very intentional statement on page 6 of the tax provisions. I would just ask you to look at the Senate fiscal staff analysis of what that meant, and I just want to make sure that the general public is aware of what this means when you index it for inflation. We're now going to have a readjustment of all these numbers. So if you would make sure, Adam, that he has the Senate fiscal staff analysis of it from 2/23/2011. Do you have that in front of you, Mr. Mossman?
I do, Madam Chair.
And so have you seen this before, Mr. Mossman?
Madam Chair, no. This is the first time I've seen this.
Okay. And if we don't index that fourth tier for inflation, according to this estimate, by the year 2015, there will be 201,123 returns with the tax increase into that 10.95% tax bracket, and 12.7% of married filers, nowhere near the 5% of filers that the governor originally talked about.
And Madam Chair, I don't have any reason to, I assume this analysis is correct, I don't have any reason to think that it is otherwise. What I would reiterate, of course, is that the governor's proposal does include indexing. It has been adjusted to include indexing of the fourth tier bracket, and that is incorporated into the numbers that he has announced publicly, and it will be included in the documentation that I thought maybe came over. Again, I'm at a little bit of a loss yesterday afternoon, but will be in the bill language and in the revised budget recommendations that come forward. So I think that this scenario or something like this scenario is what would happen if the bracket was not indexed, but the bracket in the recommendation is indexed.
Well, and Mr. Mossman, a final point on this from me is right now the only thing we have to go on is the governor's budget proposal. We don't have a bill that does anything different. And so from my point of view, this is his intention until I see something that says it's not his intention. And it's certainly not official until we get language anyway. And I know we've been operating under that assumption as well, that it's not official until we see language. So we'll wait and see the language, and hopefully the governor will make the change that you've suggested. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have another question. generally, the department has produced a policy bill and a technical bill. Are you planning on doing that this year as opposed to the omnibus bill, or have you already given that to the chair? Or?
Senator Rest, I just signed those bills yesterday,
oh, okay.
And so they will be introduced, and we will work on that, but with the budget deadlines set the way
asking.
They were. Yeah, just to accommodate the budget schedule, we'll do the budget bills first, and then we'll come back to the technical and policy bills.
And thank you, Madam Chair, for the introduction. I know we wish those would have been here sooner also, but we appreciate your taking the leadership on it.
Thank you. Members, other business? Without further business before the committee, we are adjourned.